Hello, I'm Mark Riley, and this is The Intersection, the intersection of politics and culture. Thank you so much for listening and tuning in to my podcast. Why does Donald Trump dominate the news? You may remember I said I would try to avoid talking about him on this podcast, but the plain fact of the matter is I cannot. Whether accidentally or on purpose, the man cannot help but dominate the news cycle. And I think it's most likely on purpose. The media, the same ones he has lately called traitors, have benefited financially from his presidency. Latest developments, though, merit some individual attention. First, let's talk about Iran. After that country shot down a U.S. drone, Trump came dangerously close to retaliating with military action. This, I believe, is the instinct of war hawk John Bolton, a national security advisor who has been trying to get the U.S. to destroy Iran for decades now. The national security advisor has brought on the equally hawkish Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, into his ambit. Pompeo is an interesting character on a lot of different levels, and it's interesting to see a Secretary of State. Actually, it's disheartening to see a Secretary of State who is that into and advocates for America possibly going to war. But here's the rub. U.S. outrage over the drone strike centers around the U.S. contention that it was in international waters, not over Iranian territory. Now, the Iranians produced on film some debris that they said was from the drone, which would imply that maybe it was on Iranian territory or over Iranian territory. But no matter. The conclusion that it was over international waters came from U.S. intelligence. Now, would that be the same U.S. intelligence that Donald Trump has roundly criticized since the beginning of his presidency? And to top that off, Trump was the one who walked away from the Iran deal negotiated by Barack Obama. And I think we all know why Trump decided to walk away. And see, when you walk away from an agreement that your country has signed, it kind of opens the door for all kinds of things to take place. Now, think for a moment what it would be like if an Iranian drone was flying somewhere close to the U.S. My guess is, international waters or not, it would probably be destroyed. But here's the other rub in all this. Trump was willing to take military action over the shooting down of a drone, not a strike that cost lives, not over some overt military action. Although they say, to Trump and Bolton and Pompeo, that this is or was a strike against U.S. military assets. Well, yeah, if a drone is considered to be an asset. Now, I don't understand why it is that Trump can say on the one hand that the U.S. intelligence community didn't know what it was doing, and on the other hand, cite U.S. intelligence for saying that this drone was struck down in international waters. After all, it is, and all of the people in the Trump administration who've spoken about this have said the same thing. U.S. intelligence confirmed for us. So how do you have it both ways? How do you say they're incompetent on the one hand and then use their information to conclude that the Iranian drone strike was over international waters? Now, the other question is, would tensions be as high as they are if the Iran deal had remained intact? Questions I believe need to be answered by somebody or another. In the end, though, this was about the following. There have been people in and around the American presidency that believe endless war benefits the nation. Now, they may not say so publicly. They may not call a press conference and say, yeah, we believe in endless war. But the people, and make no mistake, John Bolton is the leader of this group, this cabal of people that believe America has some obligation to effect regime change in Iran. They just don't like the Iranian political setup. And of course, underneath all this is the question of whether or not Iran is developing a nuclear weapon. Well, if you really wanted to be sure about that, the smart move would have been to stay in the agreement. The agreement appears to have been working. Now, the people that believe in endless war didn't start believing this last week. This is not new. Neither is thinking it's fine for the world's superpower to call territories far from our own U.S. assets and therefore feel free to send drones and other military equipment to spy on what they believe to be our enemies. Now, some people might argue perfectly legit to have a drone, an American drone, thousands of miles from America, looking at another country, because that's what they were doing. They didn't fly that drone for a test, believe that. And then you strip away everything, everything. And what is this really all about? What is this in pursuit of? The plain fact is oil interests, fossil fuels. Otherwise, the Straits of Hormuz, which America seems determined to keep open, would mean nothing to us. Think about this. Absent the seeming necessity of fossil fuels in our life, would the Middle East itself mean as much to U.S. national interests as we constantly say it is? The logical conclusion out of all this, and I think progressives in particular need to take note of this fact, the Green New Deal, yes, the Green New Deal that everybody badmouths, is actually a national security issue. Just don't tell Bolton or Pompeo or Donald Trump. Could it be that politicians deride the Green New Deal because they support endless war? I'm just asking. Do they back, and I think it's pretty much a given, that they back the established order. And the established order is about changing governments in places that we have a problem with, that we have a beef with. Now, the question becomes, is that the best effort of the United States? Is it what the United States ought to be doing? I say the answer is no. Absolutely no. But you have to ask yourself, with everything else Donald Trump has done, is endless war a legacy of the Trump presidency? It very well could be, even though somebody told him that a retaliatory strike that would cost human life over the shooting down of an unmanned projectile, a drone, would be seen across the world as a huge, and I do mean huge, overreaction on the part of the United States. I believe that that's what caused Donald Trump at the last minute to say, no, we're not going to retaliate, at least not now. Bolton, of course, continues to say that refusing to strike now doesn't mean we won't strike later, because he has to propagate this belief that America has a national security interest in ridding itself and ridding the world of the Iranian government. Now, I'm not saying that the Iranians are perfect or that their government is a place that I would want to live under. Not saying that at all. But I think it's important to note that America supports certain regimes in that area while at the same time deriding others. Maybe the side that we deride and the side that we support are equally despotic in the way they do things. A lot of the reason why we're fencing with Iran has to do with Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has a problem with Iran. Whether it's a legitimate problem or not, anybody's guess. I'm not going to sit here and say I know one way or the other. It's above my pay grade. But I do know that in siding with the Saudis, we are siding with people who allegedly sent people to this country to assassinate a journalist, to kill someone. There's been no account. No one's been brought to account for that. And my guess is the Trump administration is not going to make anybody be held to account for that. Inside, outside the Saudi government, people who have a nod and a wink with the Saudi government. But that all gets back to Iran and why the tensions between the U.S. and the Iranians is so high. It could be that a different president might try and pull back on the hostilities, might try and renegotiate the nuclear deal that we first signed on to and then withdrew from. Makes sense. At this point, however, it's a big however, there's an issue of trust. Do the Iranians trust that if the Americans do come back and sign some kind of agreement limiting their development of nuclear weapons in exchange for a lifting of sanctions, which are hurting Iran, why would the Iranians trust that the United States would hold true to the bargain? If all it took was regime change in this country, Barack Obama to Donald Trump, to have the U.S. walk away from a deal that it made. It all makes little, if no sense, but it's something that we ought to think about when we look at the Iranian situation overall. Now, I'm not saying that I believe the Iranians. At the end of the day, maybe it was shot down, that drone, over international waters. It's possible. But do you see that as a mistake? Do you see that as a provocation? Do you see that as something that is worth a military strike? Donald Trump decided no. Maybe the first thing he's done since he's been president, I actually agree with. But you see, what it says to me is that there was a U.S. political reason for pulling back. That Americans, whether they be Republicans in Congress or people on the streets, don't want to shed American blood in any way, shape, or form to affect regime change in Iran. John Bolton and his ilk are perfectly willing to do so. Be clear about that. John Bolton wants regime change so bad that he would, I believe, sacrifice American lives, the lives of American soldiers, to make that happen. Now, that's not to say that we would nuke Iran or anything like that. You don't need to necessarily be an alarmist about this. But the fact of the matter is, these people want to see a conflict with Iran as part of a larger process of endless war, which I think they believe is good for America. I don't think most Americans think it's good for America. And John Bolton isn't going there and fighting anybody. He's not dropping bombs or going on the ground, taking territory. He's not doing any of that. He depends on the U.S. military to do that. And if, in fact, and I could be wrong, but if, in fact, John Bolton is willing to back up his rhetoric, which has obviously been hawkish, with some recommendation for military action, we all got problems, folks. A very, very big problem. Maybe they see the economy slowing down just a wee bit and think that people will be diverted. People's attention will be diverted from a possible economic slowdown by a war with Iran. And, you know, Donald Trump says very simply, if Iran goes to war with us, we're going to win. And he's probably right about that. America is, in fact, the preeminent power. But people also don't look or don't seriously consider exactly how that drone strike played in Iran. From the reports I've seen, the Iranians were celebrating because to them, it shows they have the power to do something about what they consider U.S. intrusions on their territory. Now, again, they have their own reasons for saying that this drone was downed over Iranian territory. Obviously, they have reasons to do that. If it's in international waters, it might be problematic for a lot of people. But the bottom line here is this, folks. We came dangerously close to going to war. And over what? A drone strike? I don't think so. And apparently, Donald Trump didn't think so either. But that doesn't mean that tensions with Iran are going to go down. And it doesn't mean that at some point we might strike Iran. And then what will happen? Again, thanks so much for listening to the podcast. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, immigration raid, no immigration raid, or what? This is The Intersection.
Listen, discover, think. It's Intelligent News Analysis with Mark Riley.
Paresseuse, paresseuse, elle est paresseuse. Est-ce vraiment la paresse ou trop de quoi ou qu'est-ce?
Welcome back to The Intersection. My name is Mark Riley. Send me an email at mark@markrileymedia.com. mark@markrileymedia.com. And now, immigration. The second reversal on the part of the Trump administration in less than a week. Donald Trump, historically, we need to have a little context here, has used immigration as a crutch as he began to contemplate a run for the presidency. He reportedly did so, according to one published report, at the request of one of his aides, who said he needed some kind of hook, and that immigration was, in fact, that hook. Given that he's President Trump, the evidence would suggest that immigration was a winning issue for him. A winning issue for him. And then you have to start asking yourself, why? And the answer is simple. Immigration is red meat to the grievance wing of the Republican Party. That aide that told him to emphasize immigration, he was absolutely right. That red meat grievance wing of the Republican Party is who Trump has always, always appealed to. With that as some context, word that the administration planned massive raids to detain and deport undocumented immigrants should come, first of all, as no surprise. What was surprising was that Trump woke up and realized he had promised something that he could not, in fact, deliver. Deport millions? Not a chance. So now he uses a tried and true tactic. Pressure the Democrats in Congress to come up with a deal or the deportations will start in 2 weeks. See, this is no different than the way Donald Trump did business outside the U.S. presidency. Make a deal. Make something where you can come out and say you won. That even the media, the purveyors of fake news, would have to say that you won. Now, the ranking member of the House Armed Services Committee says Trump backed off because of concerns expressed by, quote, people on the Hill, unquote. That would not be Democrats, folks. That would be Republican senators and Republican congresspeople. That means, at the very least, since this was the ranking member of the House Armed Services Committee, that Republican GOP House members didn't like it. Yet for Donald Trump, immigration is and will remain red meat for his supporters, meaning that his administration is prepared to play dodgeball with the lives of millions of people living in this country. Millions of people who are living in this country, rightly or wrongly. And to those who argue that the undocumented are breaking the law, because that is the most frequent refrain that you hear from people who support mass deportation, starting, of course, with another presidential aide, Stephen Miller, those folks believe with every fiber of their being that people who come here and are not documented are breaking the law, period, end. And that in doing so, they risk detention and eventual deportation. And it's interesting to look closely at who some of those millions of people, in fact, are. And we ought to be clear about the fact that American laws, both big and small, are broken in this country each and every day. Little things, and in many cases, big things. And yes, politicians break the law just like everybody else. Not all of them, obviously, but some of them do. Some of them have actually gone to jail for it. But they are reading directly, I think, from Republican talking points. I don't think they may believe that large numbers of people need to be deported, but they have a great deal of difficulty explaining why. And I believe that's because they haven't really done the deep dive into why. They're just spouting Republican talking points. It all, in my judgment, comes under the general heading of xenophobia. Why, you might ask? Well, let's look at some numbers. You know, numbers are interesting. These are numbers according to our friends at the Pew Research Center. Despite the administration and the national fixation on Mexicans, their numbers have declined from 2007 through 2017. That's right. The number of Mexicans coming into this country, quote, illegally, unquote, has been dropping from 2007 through 2017. Now, numbers may be going up at this point, but those are people crossing the border between Mexico and the U.S. They're not necessarily Mexicans. More on that in a minute. Numbers are going up. As opposed to the Mexicans who have been declining, numbers are going up from both Central America and Asia. You don't hear much about Asia, do we? We don't hear anything about Asian immigrants coming here in massive numbers and needing to be deported, et cetera, et cetera. And by the way, in saying that, I'm not saying we should be looking at that or that we should put the same kind of sick emphasis on Asia that we have on Mexico. Part of the reason why Trump is trying to pressure the Mexican government to do something about migration comes from the fact that they're not just talking about from Mexico. They're also talking about Central America, most notably Guatemala. But you can add to that Honduras and El Salvador. Now, why, you might ask yourself, has there been very little public pressure put on Guatemala to stop their people from coming into Mexico with the end game of coming to the United States? Have they put sanctions on Guatemala? Are there tariffs on Guatemalan goods? Probably not, because I don't know how much we import from Guatemala. But we certainly haven't heard much. Now, I don't need to tell you that the flow of the undocumented immigrants from Asia does not come from the southern border. They come through airports. And the Trump administration has tried to say that they are trying to cut that down. I don't know how successful they have been. We don't hear much about people coming into this country illegally, if you want to put it that way, through airports, as opposed to the southern border. Now, there are a lot of reasons for that, and there are people who believe that race is primary among them. Leave that aside for a moment. Not just race, but nationality as well. You don't hear much about people coming through airports. But the capper is this, and this is really interesting. About two-thirds of the undocumented immigrants living in the United States have been living here for 10 years or more. That's 66% of the undocumented immigrants in the United States have been living here for 10 years or more. That means if Trump does start trying to deport people in large numbers, it will cause massive, massive disruption of people's lives. Because there will be some people, for example, children born to undocumented inside the United States, who have a legal right to stay here. So what happens if their parents came illegally 10 years ago in 2009, have been living here, have been paying taxes, I emphasize, have been paying taxes and working. They're not taking advantage of the American system. They're not getting all kinds of benefits that the U.S. offers its citizens. But two-thirds have been living here for 10 years or more. Now, one of the things that says is that these folks have managed, probably through family ties and community ties, to become part of the American fabric. Now, what the Trump administration and people who support them argue is that these folks who have been here, even if they've been here for 10 years, you don't want to set the precedent of saying, okay, well, they've been here this long, but that doesn't mean they didn't break the law when they came here in the first place. That's the argument that these people come with. The law, the law, the law. Is it legitimate? I don't think it is, to be honest with you. You know, there's just too many instances when the law is violated. See, because that cornerstone means that it doesn't matter what people do when they get here. It doesn't matter if they're working and paying taxes and doing everything that documented Americans do because they came illegally. They broke the law. And a lot of people argue that, you know, these people, if they're here, they should be deported back to their countries. And if they want to come back, they should get in a queue. No one seems to ask, why is there such a queue? Why is it that it takes years in some cases for people to get cleared to come here through conventional means? Now, that's not to say that people should pour over the border and that's all fine, you know, because that's the first thing they come at you with. Well, you're for open borders. Well, you know, I believe there's a case that can be made for open borders, if that's what you want to call it. But let's leave that aside for a moment, because after all, we do have laws. You don't really end up in a situation where you're deporting people who've been here for extended periods of time. And there's another question I'd like to ask about all this. They talk about the undocumented immigrant problem from Mexico, from Guatemala, from El Salvador, from Honduras. One place that they're not talking about is Costa Rica. There's no Costa Rican crisis. There are no huge numbers of people running from Costa Rica trying to get to the United States. Why does anyone think that is? Because Costa Rica has set up a government that is satisfying to a majority of its people. They don't want to go anyplace. They want Americans to come to Costa Rica, in some cases to settle there. They're not part of the problem, yet they're in the same region. And I think that there's a lesson to be learned from Costa Rica, where America could use its influence with places like Guatemala and Honduras and El Salvador and start to try and build their economies and help them cut down on violence where it is a problem, because a lot of people that come here from these countries say they are fleeing violence, that they feel their lives are at stake, their lives are in jeopardy. And quite frankly, I think it'd be pretty difficult for a lot of the American bureaucracy to figure out who was legit and who was not. I mean, that's their job, that's what they end up having to do, but how do they do it? How do they know when someone has a legitimate fear of being killed in some cases? It's not without precedent, folks. All this is to say that America's immigration problem requires a multifaceted fix, not ICE raids. And I will bet you that if they start doing this, they're going to start by trying to target sanctuary cities, because sanctuary cities are the thorn in the side of the Trump administration. They are deliberately and vocally being defiant, saying, I don't care what Donald Trump says, this is what we as a city are going to do. And quite frankly, I'm proud to be living and working in places where there are sanctuary cities. New York City is a sanctuary city. And I think the Trump administration is going to find, if they try to start to do this, they are going to meet resistance. I'm not talking about violence now. I'm not talking about people going in the street and shooting people up. That's for the right wing to do in places like Charlottesville. This is not about that. And that wasn't even shooting somebody, I believe. I think that was running somebody over. The bottom line is There needs to be a fix, a serious fix, to the American immigration system. And then the focus ought to be, as it was during the Obama administration, even though Obama was criticized for the number of people who were deported, the bottom line is that they were deporting criminals. If people were convicted of crimes either in their home country or in the United States, that's who they were going after, and that's who they should, in fact, go after. But you see, that's not the way the system works. The system, according to Donald Trump and his ilk, the system is supposed to work to bring in certain people while keeping certain others out. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is utterly wrong. I feel really bad about this, I really do, but I gotta talk about Trump one more time. Because when we come back, it's a twofer. One, another woman accuses Donald Trump of sexual assault. And two, Joe Biden and the segregationists. This is The Intersection. Welcome back. This is The Intersection. I'd love to hear from you on my Facebook page, Mark Riley Media. Thank you so much for sticking and staying with us. Our final twofer section tonight deals with, first, another accuser of Donald Trump, another woman. And it goes into the normal situation when it comes to accusations against the president, of which there are either 20, 21. You accuse, deny, repeat. Accuse, deny, repeat. In this case, advice columnist E. Jean Carroll says that what Donald Trump did was rape her. Trump responded by saying he'd never met the woman, even though a 1987 photo shows the two of them together with their then spouses. Her book chronicles a brutal 1990s encounter with Trump at Bergdorf Goodman in Manhattan. Responding to the photo, the president, as is his habit, doubled down, saying, you know, my back was to the camera. Just because I was in the picture frame doesn't mean I knew these people. Da-da-da-da-da-da. But ask yourself this question. If 20, 21, 23 people accused one person of any type of impropriety, much less sexual impropriety, who would you believe? The fact is, there will be no damage to Donald Trump from this latest accusation. Keep in mind that Donald Trump is only concerned with getting reelected next year. And at this point, he figures, I'll just deny it and it'll go away. And why would he say such a thing? Because all the others that he denied eventually went away. You haven't heard about any of them in the news, except that there are numbers of women who have accused him of this. Now, keep this in mind. This was in the 1990s, I think either 95 or 96, a while ago, true. But ask yourself, if any other person who was leading the country was accused of rape, would there be an investigation? I think so. And if it turned out that the preponderance of evidence favored E. Jean Carroll, what would happen? What would happen to a sitting president? He would be pressured to leave. They wouldn't necessarily impeach him. They can't impeach him over conduct done way before he became president. That they could not do. But there certainly would be pressure put on most American presidents. Certainly, if Barack Obama had been accused of such a thing, there would be pressure on him to resign, and resign quickly. And we've seen numbers of politicians who have ended up having to leave office because of credible, I emphasize, credible accusations of sexual misconduct. Now, Donald Trump's logic is very simple. If all the accusations against him up through 2016 did not keep him out of the White House, why would a single accusation like this keep him out of the White House or have him kicked out of the White House electorally next year? There are some facts that we have to face here. And they're, how best to put this, ugly facts. The women's movement, despite the Me Too movement, women are not taken seriously when they accuse some men of sexual misconduct. How else can you look at all the accusations against Donald Trump? I mean, you can believe they all lied. You can believe they were all paid off by somebody. Trump loves to say that the Democrats had paid some of these people. He offered no proof, but he says it anyway, because proof is not necessary to his base. If he says it, they believe it. It's as simple as that. Despite Me Too, women are not taken seriously when they accuse some men, not all men, but some men of sexual misconduct. That's because time and again, America shows its gross disrespect for women. That would include, by the way, the draconian anti-abortion laws passed in states across this country. You don't think there's a connection between people not believing 20 women who give accounts of sexual misconduct by Donald Trump? You don't think there's a connection between that and laws that in some instances restrict and in some cases out and out prohibit a woman's right to choose what to do with her own body? I believe there's a connection. Call me silly, call me stupid, call me crazy. But I do, in fact, believe that, you know, there, if it's a duck and walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it is not a mastodon. And this thing will probably disappear over time, this accusation. You know, you go back to the mid-90s, first they'd have to establish that Trump was in Bergdorf Goodman at the time she says he was, and she seems to be a little fuzzy about exactly when this took place. But she was pretty graphic about what happened, you know, because she wrote a book, you know, and apparently Trump wasn't the only man who did E. Jean Carroll wrong. That's for sure. I think we have to think about the connections between people who would say, no, you can't have the right to do what you wish with your own body, and people who believe Donald Trump when he says, I never knew the woman. All these people, they're all false accusations, all of them, every last one of them, probably put together by Democrats. That's what he says to people. And people apparently, to some small extent, buy in. That's why there needs to be substantive change in America. And it ought to start with some true respect for women. Finally, Joe Biden, the presumptive frontrunner at this point in the polls for the Democratic nomination for the presidency. I got a question. Does Joe Biden ever miss an opportunity to put his foot in his mouth? You know, when he was making the point that he got along with people with whom he disagreed, he could have said very simply that he managed to get along well with people he disagreed with, in some cases vehemently, politically. Simple, right? A very simple thing to say. But that's not what Joe Biden said. He ended up saying that he was BFFs with two arch segregationists, Herman Talmadge and James Eastland, that is, both vicious racists. Don't believe me? Google James Eastland and blacks and see what you come up with. Anyway, Biden reacted to criticism from fellow senator and fellow presidential candidate Cory Booker by saying at first that Booker should apologize to him. For what? Who knows? Understand that Joe Biden has a lot to lose here, because if he loses the support of black people, he's got a very serious problem that the polling may not show right away, but eventually it will. Now, to be fair, he sort of backed off what he apparently said to and about Cory Booker. He supposedly reached out to Cory Booker through back channels and tried to explain, and some say apologize for kind of pushing back on Cory Booker's criticism of him. Biden's popularity at the polls has a great deal to do with his support in the black community. If he loses that support, make no mistake about it, he's got serious problems. Now, there have been some black people I've seen on television who argue that Joe Biden was simply speaking a truth inartfully. In other words, not smart. One might want to, if you believe that, ask yourself if Joe Biden is gaffe prone, because this isn't the first time that there have been problems with things that Joe Biden has said. Even stuff he said about Barack Obama, for God's sake. Not everybody was on board. But Biden, more than anybody else, and I got to be honest with you, people say, well, you know, Biden's a moderate. That's why he appeals to so many people. I don't know if that's the reason why he appeals to black people, but I can tell you that the progressive wing of the Democratic Party has not done enough to appeal to black people and give black people a reason to come out and vote for them. I mean, there's a lot of people in the race. What is it, 25 now? I think somebody just announced. So there is that. But the other side of the equation is some of the people who even have been doing well in the polls, some say surging in the polls, they need to do more outreach to the black community. They have to contest that vote if you assume that Joe Biden at this point has the majority of it. I don't know if he does. And that brings me to another issue, which I was going to take another episode to talk about. But while we're at it, you know, they recently had this, I guess, culling process to decide who would be included in the first presidential debate. And it was a function of two things, both of which I think are wrong to assess someone's access to a debate. One is polling. You know, and some people have 1% in the polls, some people have 0.whatever% in the polls. Fine. But to use polling and to a lesser extent, fundraising, because fundraising, it's very difficult for the media not to cover how much money these people have in fact raised. It's part of the horse race. It's like the Derby for politicians. So they do fundraising and they do polling. And between those two things, they decide who should be a part of a debate. I think that's wrong. Now, 25 people is a lot of people. Under normal circumstances, it would be unwieldy in a single debate. Do what you must. But please, don't allow our political process to kind of cheapen itself, in my judgment, and maybe cheapen is a little bit harsh, but to cheapen itself by saying you have to do a certain thing. You have to have a certain polling number, even though most people will say that polling is an imprecise science. But they use it to decide who can sit up and talk at a debate. Now, that doesn't mean that the debate is not going to be necessary, that it's not going to be well put together and well thought of with the people who are allowed. I think the cutoff was 20 people who are allowed to participate. But I think we have to think about some kind of different criteria for deciding if you're going to push people out, have a good reason. And in my judgment, polling is not a good enough reason. That's just my take on it. But Joe Biden, you got some work to do, my friend. And, you know, being the moderate in this race, being the front runner in this race, you're going to have a target on your back anyway. You should have expected Cory Booker, an African-American, to say something. And I salute him for saying something about Joe Biden bragging about how he cozied up to racists. I don't think there's anything wrong with people calling him on that. We'll see if it hurts moving forward. Thank you so much for listening to my podcast. My executive producer is Ms. Kim Jack Riley. Till we meet again, please be well.